Hello, hello. Welcome to the Cycling Central podcast for the week of the 19th of February 2015. Something to keep you entertained when you finish that last episode of Serial. I'm Al Hines. This week on the show, a Belgie passes before his time. Helmets are good, but also bad. A painted bike lane shouldn't be demonised. How not to fix a crank arm on a pursuit bike, and summarising the shambles of a half decade at Cycling Australia. That's all in this week's podcast. And with me to talk all things cycling, it's Phil Gomes, Anthony T-Dog Tan, and Ride Media's Rob Arnold. Guys, welcome aboard.
Thank you, Al. It's good to be out of the kennel.
Yeah, it was. Well, you were out of the kennel last week as well. You don't like the kennel that much these days.
No. Let's get on with it, Al.
Yeah, Rob, how are you? Good to have you back. You had a magazine to finish.
Still working. That's a production deadline coming up, and we'll be printing on sale in March, around the 10th, if all goes well.
And Filippo.
May I just say...
Yeah, that's right.
It's just the general clearing of the throat.
That's right. In the rehearsal for this podcast, we did have Phil clearing his throat literally on cue. It was beautiful. Try and do that as much as possible.
We don't rehearse this, so how could there be a rehearsal?
Well, it's a rehearsal of the rehearsal.
I just want to point out that this is utterly impromptu discussion.
It is live. Right. And I think no one would be mistaken for that.
A pre-rehearsal.
Yeah. All right, guys.
The intro.
First up, I want to get straight into it with some talk about a guy, a Belgian, famous Belgian, who sadly passed away. He had a stroke the other day, Claude Crickleyon. He's 58, sadly passed well before his time. But Crickleyon, Phil, he probably is most well renowned for an incident that happened in the 1988 World Championships. I'm sure a lot of our listeners don't know this, but it did affect you quite a lot because of the fact that it was a guy who was involved with in that race that I suppose we now remember him, Steve Bauer, Canadian, and they had a legal dispute over the fact that Crickleyon forced him into the barrier, Bauer forced him into the barriers. Crickleyon protested, was DQ'd, Bauer was DQ'd rather, and the legal case went on for 3 or 4 years, and it was an assault charge that he was trying to lay on him.
Yep. Let's just say alleged. Pushed him into the rails because, you know, even today, I mean, it's not necessarily conclusive. But, you know, in court, the evidence was that that Bauer was actually reacting to being pushed by Crickleyon. But if we can just take it back just a second, Crickleyon's famous because he won the World Championships in 1984.
Yeah.
He's also a guy who's finished as high as fifth at the Tour de France. If you take a look, if you head over to Wikipedia and you take a look at his career palmarès, it's extensive. Classics like you wouldn't believe everywhere. I mean, he's won a lot of stuff. Mm. So he's a first-class bike rider. But the interesting thing, and myself...
He was also one of the last great Belgians. I mean, we haven't had a really great Belgian for many.
Johan Museo, come on, man. Tom Boonen. We've had some great Belgians since. But, you know, he's from a different age as well.
Mm. But he was sort of the transient point between Merckx and the next generation.
Yes,
he was a superstar.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. But... the reason it resonates with me, or his death resonates with me, of course, is because, the rider he was involved with, that incident at the 88 World Championships, was Steve Bauer, who still remains today pretty much the greatest
Canadian
bike rider of all time.
Still say above Ryder Heyerdahl.
Still above Ryder Heyerdahl. I know. But you
don't
know,
go there, Phil.
Don't get me started.
It's just sort of something about your generation, isn't it? That's why.
Get off my lawn. That's right. So you had this incident with Crickleyon as they were coming into finale sprint in 1988 World Championships, which was in Belgium, and
in Reims,
there was an altercation along the barriers, and Crickleyon fell off, and then Maurizio Fondrist slipped through for the win, good times for the Italians.
I mean, there's great vision,
But the biggest vision is of them walking to the line, of Crickleyon walking to the line with his arm in the air. He was already
protesting.
The protest was on, and it would last forever until yesterday when he died. He was still protesting that he was the rightful
winner of that race. And of course, you know, from his perspective, like if you look at the video, and you can find this video on YouTube. I mean, you look at that finale, and it was a terrific sprint anyway, regardless. Mm. But you look at the sidelines, and you can see so many fans. It was just packed. Mm. So for a Belgian, you can understand his emotions at the time, and you can understand his ongoing emotions, because for a Belgian to win the World Championships in Belgium would have been literally the crowning glory of his career. Mm. There wouldn't have been anything else that he could have done that would have been much better than that.
The funny thing is, isn't it?
But even if he had won, he wouldn't have been as famous for the incident as he was for having crashed.
True. but that's exactly right. But it's interesting to me, too, because growing up and being in Canada, living in Canada at the time, you know, it was actually a big deal there, too. It broke through the whole hockey media conglomerate. You know, and we all knew about this thing, you know, and it was a big deal. And then it dragged on and, you know, and eventually it came to some conclusion in court. But as Rob just said, the conclusion really...
Quickly on, never totally came to terms with the defeat. In fact, I think Marc Sejean, in one of the many,
obituaries.
Obituary. Well, not quite an obituary, but just a memory, I suppose, of one of his great memories of quickly on, he said, you know, like, I rode with him and he was a great competitor, a great rival, but I never felt like he totally... That 1988 point in his career, it could have gone two ways. And because of the way that he dwelled on it, because of the way the legal case sort of just went on and on and on, it sort of shadowed the back end of his career. And he said he really wasn't the same rider afterwards, even aside from retiring and going on with his life. I think it changed his whole trajectory of his career, which is interesting. But I mean, these things do happen.
Yeah, it's one of the great stories in professional cycling is that incident in 1988. Mm. So, but Vale, Claude Crickleyon.
Yes, indeed. And if you want to, as Phil mentioned, if you want to check out Vision, there's some good Vision of that on YouTube. As it's pretty much everything these days.
You've got an article.
Years ago, Rupert Guinness talked about the legacy of the incident in Roms, and it was a big deal. I'll try and find it and pop it online because it did relate to how significant that whole thing.
Well, let's have it. We'll tweet it out.
Yeah.
Check it up on Facebook.
Sounds good.
Bring that to life again.
Mm. All right. Mm. We'll move on, and we're going to get into a very big segue. We're going to talk about bike lanes and helmets. I know that's fertile ground for discussion, so we'll get straight into that after this break. Well, we're joined now by Fairfax rider Michael O'Reilly, an expert on all things urban cycling and a regular guest of this podcast. He wrote a piece on bike lanes this week and sort of a follow-up to another piece that he wrote. And it was, I suppose, going into the debate about the painted line bike lane, not necessarily the separated bike infrastructure one, but there was a bit of pushback from Michael's readership about whether the simple painted line was in fact as bad as I suppose a lot of us make out. And I suppose we've all had this experience where you ride down a painted bike lane and you got the sort of threat of car doors, you don't feel totally safe, you've got the cars on the other side, and obviously all of us would prefer separated infrastructure. But it was interesting, Michael, I suppose, as you sort of explored, it's they're not all bad. They do actually encourage people who you might not think to jump on bikes.
Yeah, I'd say that is the case. It's one of the big problems, I think, with Australian infrastructure is that it can be so incredibly variable. I mean, quite often a bike lane that's a painted lane has a little buffer zone, which is, you know, which is between the lane and the car doors. I was talking to some of the infrastructure experts and talking about how different they can be. But I think and so that would be an improvement. I think the ones that really freak us out and personally quite annoy me is when it's a super narrow lane which is just right in the door zone. And I related an incident in my blog for Fairfax Media this week talking about how I was riding and I was just right on the white line all the way on the right hand side because I didn't want to be in that door zone. And then somebody came past and sort of yelled at me to get in the bike lane, and I'm thinking, actually what you want me to do is get into the car door opening lane because that's what it is to me right now.
Yeah.
And the problem there is that I think that novice riders will think I should stay in there because it's safe, and it's not necessarily. And also motorists coming past see that you're not in the lane and think, well, the council designed that, so it's got to be perfect. Why isn't the guy riding in it is taking the piss? So that was the discussion. And it's interesting to hear the people who work in infrastructure talking about how basically, they said sometimes bad infrastructure is still better than no infrastructure because it concentrates bike use and it gives more visibility to cyclists. So there's a bit of both ways about that.
Yeah, I mean, Mike, what it was interesting, I thought, was they're talking about particularly the gender question, because even I think the stat which you quoted, or maybe it was one of the people you talked to, said in Melbourne a simple painted bike lane will result in some 20% of riders being women climbing to something like 45%. So, I mean, even just something like that, getting more inclusiveness, getting more people on the road, I mean, that's obviously a win.
Absolutely the case. And yeah, you're quoting the figures given to me by Gary Brennan of Bicycle Network. I'm always nervous of gender discussions, but I think there's a common perception that your risk takers more tend to be, you know, the sort of blokes of a certain age. And I've been down to Melbourne, and it's quite astonishing, just to me anecdotally, what they're doing down there, and the higher percentage of cyclists and women cyclists riding in a more European style there, and yeah, if you start creating protected infrastructure, it brings the nervous or the uncertain or the non-risk taking cyclist, and that would, you know, be better for all of us.
Yeah, Mike, I sort of have, this is more of a comment rather than a question, but my feeling is that, yeah, I quite like the idea of bike lanes, but almost in all cases, the bike lane is simply just not wide enough. And so a typical example is the Pacific Highway in Sydney. You know, you basically, it provides almost no shelter from the traffic. In fact, I would probably prefer that there wasn't a bike lane on the highway, because that way, okay, you're in an actual car lane, and then the cars will then have to go into another lane to overtake you. In the bike lane, it's so narrow they feel that they can overtake you. It's almost a permission to overtake. But I don't actually feel safe because it is so narrow.
Well, you're creating a corridor, aren't you?
I mean, there's no, it's certainly not a meter wide.
No.
Yeah. This, you know, as I said at the beginning, and there are great photo galleries online that you can find. I ran one a couple of years ago about, you know, epic bike lane infrastructure fails, where things are just so half-assed. And it is really horses for courses. But I did find it interesting, and this is with these people who work in council talking about how so often it's a staged process. And yes, absolutely, I think we as cyclists would love to see an entire Dutch infrastructure system just fall from the sky in a sort of grid pattern across Melbourne and Sydney and Brisbane and wherever else. We would love that to happen. And we would love to see the really good infrastructure put in sooner and more extensively. Mm. But I guess that the reality bites kind of thing is how we have to look at it as well. And sometimes incremental processes, if they lead on to better things, can be more beneficial than spending, as one expert was telling me, 3 years and vast amounts of money to just get 500 meters of decent Copenhagen lane built in one area, with all the kerfuffle and the people whinging about cost and losing of parking and stuff like that. So it's about creating space while encouraging the need.
I think it's getting to the point where the city, the congestion in the city is going to dictate that the bike has to get a bit of infrastructure. And I brought it up a couple of months ago, but I did an interview with Willem Kossain, who's the Consul General from Holland, and he lives in Sydney, and he was shocked by how dangerous it was to ride here. And he was reminding me, and it's a pivotal thing, is that it's legislation that turned Holland into a cycling nation. It wasn't the fact that it's flat or it's conducive to cycling, because it's not as conducive to cycling as most Australian cities is. It's cold, it can be wet, it's, you know, different things like that. Okay, it's flat. But they just realised that there were too many cars in the city and that they had to change it, and they made a conscious effort to across all realms of government, from local council right through to national, if they built a new road, there had to be a separate bike lane. And it's just so logical. And I think that if you drive in Melbourne or Brisbane or Sydney or even, you know, in Adelaide at times, it can get so congested that you see that there's no solution other than to get on a bike. Yeah. And you only do that if it's safe. And that's what you're talking about, Michael, is trying to make sure that the bike lane that runs alongside the road is safe.
I saw you with your two sons on the weekend, and you were obviously riding in just a painted line bike lane along Crown Street. And I mean, now the traffic along there is quite slow. But I mean, how do you find that riding with, you know, your two young sons?
It's a key point. I ride with my 9-year-old and my 4-year-old on the front of my bike, and I never, ever, ever stop talking to them. Every minute of the ride, we're talking about what instruction to do next. And when we're in those lanes, I'm always saying, left of the white line, mate, left of the white line. And also look into the car mirrors, because you want to see if there's a driver in there about to exit. And Louis, my 9-year-old, knows to ride in that danger zone, but it's allocated as a bike lane, and to look into the mirrors, look to his right, follow where cars are. And if you drill it into everyone, and unfortunately not everyone can have that sort of instruction, then there are ways and means of making it a little bit more viable than otherwise is.
I want to quickly move on to...
Or not, Michael. I don't know.
Well, I want to quickly move on to away from bike lanes, but Mike, also one of the things that's been talked about recently is, I suppose because Sarah Wilson's been spruiking a bit of helmet issues, and she's been talking about the mandatory helmet law legislation, mandatory helmet laws. But she raised the point, I mean, this is a sort of not a new point, I suppose, but more that... you know, the critical mass argument, having more bums out there is ultimately much safer than anything that mandatory helmet laws can do, because mandatory helmet laws decrease participation. So I suppose, you know, we've had this conversation before, but is it time maybe to re-address or re-look at some of these laws? Or
I certainly would think so. But then I think my I've expressed my views on these issues before, and I love the fact that Sarah's going out there and she's taking a pasting on certain levels of social media. People, if you go to her Instagram account, people are like, unfollow, you know, how dare you? And it's just amazing. I go back to that the Chinese proverb of the frog in the well thinks that the whole world is the well. And, you know, we are one of two countries in the world that enforces these laws. And the question, and I think people's pushback on this always falls down when you ask them this question, is Australian cycling safer as a result of 25 years of mandatory helmet laws? Is this a cycling safety haven? Does the rest of the world come here and think, gosh, we wish we had those laws because we'd be safe like you guys? Whether any politician is going to have the courage to address those laws, I don't know. I think if they were quietly relaxed, that'd be great. But people always get bent about the fact that it's, you know, they don't see that it's not an argument against helmets and argue against the mandation, against the enforcement of people wearing helmets. If I, you know, to borrow from the old, you know, freedom statement, I will fight for your right to wear a helmet, and I will fight for my own right to wear a helmet, because I do. Mm. But I go to so many, and Sydney is quite like this. There's so many beachside suburbs or inner city areas where people are just rolling around, not wearing a helmet in any old clothes. Sometimes if it's the busy main road, they just go on the pavement and that. And it's really, it's not a bad way of living, and I think that should be quietly encouraged. So, you know, good for Sarah for pushing out the debate.
I've actually come around a lot on this, because initially I worked in the industry when helmet legislation was brought in, and what always bugs me is when people say, well, people won't buy bikes because there's helmet legislation, which of course is complete bullshit, because people keep buying bikes anyway. Mm. But in saying that, I've come around now, and I believe that we need to ditch the laws. But my reasoning for wanting to do that is that I really want to see city bike projects, the uptake in city bike projects expand through Australia and actually get used. Because I think we're starting to see some evidence now where it looks like the helmet legislation is affecting the whole idea of city bike projects. And I think,
well, it certainly is in Sydney, because I think that Clover Moore is on the record as saying that we can't have a shared bike project or similar unless we get rid of that law. And so there's an on pass there, and she's looked at other systems. And I mean, helmets, of course, is not the the only issue quite often with those projects. It's got to do with how much you roll it out, accessibility, pricing, all of these things. But the news coming back from the way cities that you would have believed, like New York, how it's become such an incredible cycling culture here, and they're so benefiting from it. And yeah, you know, I'm glad to hear that you changed your mind. I changed my mind on the issue a few years ago. I felt strongly one way. I felt strongly the other.
In saying that, I'll still be wearing a helmet myself.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, because I don't think that. I think it's a case of having the infrastructure there to allow you to feel safe enough not to, the average layperson to feel safe enough not to wear a helmet. Secondly, I was actually in Melbourne for the Herald Sun Tour, and I did ride a bike because it was so congested on before the opening prologue that the only way I could, the trams weren't working, the taxis were all clogged up in traffic, and so I hired a bike, and it was obviously mandatory to wear a helmet, but the problem was that none of the high bikes on the rack, there was one which had a helmet, and it didn't fit my large noggin, so I was basically breaking the law, but you know, I was trying to use the most effective mode of transport. So people are obviously stealing helmets because the bikes can be locked up, but the helmets can't.
Yeah, it just adds an extra level of kerfuffle, and I think you're right about the infrastructure. But again, you know, I go to certain beach suburbs on the Sydney coastline, and there they have a few basic, you know, they've got maybe a share walk path along the beachfront and a couple of share paths going back into the hinterland of the suburbs. And you see, you know, and the thing that just makes my old middle-aged heart just beat happily is you see young women in a sundress cycling along on a share path that on an upright bike, and you just think, gee, you know, and no helmet, and you just think, is this really something that our police should be cracking down on, or should we just be laissez-faring and letting it go a bit and letting people enjoy using bikes for easy utility transport?
And I suppose, you know, the broader point as well is, you know, the more you push that idea of helmets, it's kind of that armour idea that I think Boardman talked about a little while ago as well. You sort of bring in these things like helmets, like wearing high vis, like putting on all this sort of stuff, and I think it makes something seem a lot more dangerous as well, and that also turns people off. So it's breaking down those barriers. Mike, look, thanks for having a chat. Always insightful stuff. And
Can I just jump in while you're saying farewell to Mike and say thanks for doing all that you do with regard to cycling facts. And making Absolutely. And putting it out there in the mainstream and really seeing the argument through on a thorough and regular basis. It's wonderful.
Thanks. Thank goodness it's radio, so you can't see me blushing.
I do actually have one question regarding that, though. Are you moderating the comments on those things?
No, we have a team of moderators that do it.
They're all in for PTSD now, right?
They are some of the bravest people in journalism, really. My heart goes up.
All right, Mike. Well, look, thanks for joining us. And I'd encourage everyone to look at Mike's column and Mike's piece on the Sydney Morning Herald website under Executive Style Fitness on Your Bike. And there's lots more articles similar to that on there. But Mike, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, too.
All right, let's move on. And we're going to talk about some administration woes at Cycling Australia. Well, that's right out of the 80s, but Cycling Australia's reversal in fortunes in the last 5 years has been nothing short of remarkable. 5 years ago, if you said that the organisation would be under a financial cloud, would be, you know, borrowing money from the ASC, you'd be laughed out of a clown area, like a circus maybe or something like
clown
that.
Clown school.
You'd be laughed out of clown school. Although I think that'd probably get you high marks at clown school. Anyway, neither here nor there. News over the weekend detailing the nature of Cycling Australia's financial woes was published in The Age by Samantha Lane, a controversial joint venture with Grassroots Australia, and a plan to bring in the rivers of gold that are supposedly out there. It piqued my interest. I think maybe it piqued a lot of other people's interest, and as much because it brought together years of doubts of my own and probably a lot of other people over what they were actually trying to do and what they were doing. Guys, I don't know if you've been following this at all, but you know, 2010... Michael Edgley came into the organisation. He sold this idea of what the sport could do, where it could go. And he brought with him this joint venture and tried to bring in lots more money. He wanted to capture the events that Cycling Australia weren't running. They wanted to own the events. They wanted to control the whole atmosphere. And ultimately, what worked for a little while ultimately unraveled in about 2013 when it was revealed that there was a massive black hole in Cycling Australia in terms of the funds. The balance sheet had been totally eroded. They had money in the bank. Suddenly they had a massive debt and they got bailed out by the ASC. But
what was weird about it for me is that the whole thing came from this grassroots Australia thing, and it came pretty much out of nowhere. But suddenly Michael Edgley was recruited and he had this remit that was seemed to extend far beyond. It didn't seem like anyone else had a say in the matter. It was just foisted upon everyone. And then when I met with Michael, we talked about the ambition of it, and the ambition should have been to increase membership, just like British Cycling's been able to do with all of their Sky rides and what they're doing with the Sky team, and the fact that there's enormous interest in cycling because of sport over there. The same's happening in Australia. But I don't – and I think to give credit where credit's due, there was an influx of membership, but it wasn't quite the extent that it ought to have been. And
well, I mean, this is the same year that an Australian won the Tour de France.
That's right. No, absolutely. And we had a halcyon time for cycling, and that continues to this day. But membership has plateaued, and I think that they should be driving home the message of what membership with Cycling Australia offers the punter, and that is first and foremost is insurance. You know, so you've got an opportunity to you can race, you can do all of the things that are part of Cycling Australia membership, but there is you get an insurance that you don't have otherwise, and different things like that. And it was never adequately promoted. And I think that we through our magazine tried to encourage Cycling Australia to do columns about what the benefits of the insurance schemes were. And unfortunately, they were never forthcoming. But hopefully, it'll change with the governance of Nick Green.
Yeah, I mean, I think the membership thing, they do need it. I mean, you sort of trailed, you said insurance and then trailed off, and I think that is a part of it. People don't unnecessarily, I think a lot of...
That's enough.
But I think a lot of mammals, though, you know, the sort of big AB category of potential, you know, I mean, fertile ground for, you know, commercial, you know, return... Mm. Don't necessarily buy into the idea of. I mean, they might not be racing at all. They might just be going out with their friends on a bunch ride. And these guys are not members because they don't necessarily see a return on investment becoming a member of Cycling Australia. And that, I think, is the problem that they haven't ever truly grappled, or they haven't truly got. I mean, Masters, I think, represent the largest amount of the membership, but it's still very small compared to the amount of people who are riding.
Exactly. The number of people who are members of Cycling Australia versus the number of people who ride bikes socially or for recreation or whatever. We're talking about beyond just transport. People who are riding because they're genuinely enthusiastic is immense. Like, and I think that's what Nick Green should be lobbying to achieve, and it's what Michael Edgley absolutely failed to do. Like, he brought on a few extra members, but considering everything that was going on in cycling world at that time in Australia, you know, the enormous amount of interest that we had, the membership should have spiked like it did in the UK. I don't think it has. Obviously, there's a bigger population over there. So,
yeah, but still, proportionally, probably right. I mean, it just never happened here.
Yeah,
I'm all over the place with this. You know, it's a difficult thing because, on one hand, I think that, you know, CA should sort of like revert to purely being an organization that produces medal winners and elite cyclists. On one hand, I think that. But then sometimes I think, well, you know, we still need the National Federation to be actively involved in the promotion of cycling at all levels. But isn't that
the same argument that the UCI made with promote? Isn't this the UCI almost the conundrum at a local level?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and then this is the thing. So I then think, well, you know, does CA need to be involved in promoting community style rides, fondos, whatever? Do they need to be that when you've got, say, a private, and I use that in quotation marks, like, say, like the Avian Gillow Foundation, or there could be any other promoter who may want to put on a grand fondo or something like that. Well, you know, create an environment where you allow those people to do those things. And maybe Cycling Australia needs to minimize its focus in terms of just producing, being a metal factory and doing as much as possible to get elite rubber on the road in Europe and elsewhere. But like I said, I'm a bit all over the shop on this because, you know, you really do want your national governing body to also be involved in cycling in some way at all levels. But you know,
I think the big problem is that you can go off on so many tangents, and unfortunately, I think that the power that Edgley was given allowed him to pursue multiple tangents, and he wasn't able to succeed on any of those fronts.
Yeah. Look, except selling a vision which was so poorly implemented. He did very well on one front, and that was to sell snake oil.
Yeah, but, No.
He did try to actually change an organisation which ultimately was stuck in its ways for the best part of 20 years. It didn't evolve in any way for the best part of 20 years.
You know what would be interesting is to look back.
And Cycling Australia now, compared to what it was 20 years ago, is immensely different.
Yeah. And I think a lot of that, in some ways, in a funny way, indirectly, can be credited to Edgley, because he almost forced the change.
Change that was necessary. And that's the thing. I was about to say, maybe we look back at this from, say, 5 years from now, right? And we start to put what happened then in context, and we go, well, basically, this was a moonshot. It was just a moonshot that failed. But yeah, like you say, it just affected change in other areas, and maybe it got CA. It's getting CA to really focus on the task at hand, and it's made them tighter, sharper in a long run. And you know, we may be looking at like that. We're looking at that in 5 years.
I suppose the problem is, I mean, one is that, you know, there may be a market out there. Like one point that I made, and the thing I wrote the other day, was that there also might not be, and they might be chasing this elusive dream which doesn't actually exist. And trying to chase that is just going to get them in more trouble, which
a large part of his effort, Edgley's effort, went into these cycling holidays, and I think that's where they failed. Like, Cycling Australia ought not to be a holiday promoter. An administrator, and that's what you're talking about, the conundrum of the UCI. Is it a promoter? Is it an administrator? Is it a bunch of bureaucrats making rules for the sake of making rules, and then not adhering to them? I don't know.
Yeah, I think they saw it, didn't they, Rob, as a nice money spinner, because they saw all these other tourism companies making very nice profits. You know, there's so many ex-pros sending a crew of 12 out of the Tour de France. They're prepared to pay 10 grand a head for a week in the Pyrenees or the Alps.
But that's not Cycling Australia.
But that's not, and that's the thing. They need to decide what they are and
what their bread and butter is.
Tell people that this is what they are, this is what they do, and go and do it. I actually don't know what Cycling Australia are about.
Well, ultimately, it always comes back to the fact that they get something like $15 million or $16 million as a funding from
second,
the ASC.
Second highest level of funding in Australian sport behind swimming.
Yeah, so it's
and they can't bolt on a crank.
but we'll get to that in a minute, I promise. Yeah,
that
is for the high performance program. That's what it's for. So ultimately, their remit has to be about it, until that changes in terms of the ASC's funding. It has to be about gold medals first, foremost, first, second, third, fourth.
But we did a piece in the current issue of my magazine on sale at the moment. Macy Stewart on the front cover, a junior world champion. About Victoria.
That almost sounded a bit creepy, Rob.
And Richie Porte and Campbell Flakemore on the cover.
That's right.
Three Tasman. And never mind. The point being, we did a thing about Victorian Schools Initiative and how they're taking cycle races into the school program, and that is a wonderful initiative. And CA would have been far better off pursuing something along those lines, which is encouraging grassroots participation, which you would expect from a company called Grassroots Australia, rather than high-end hoity-toity people spending $10,000 on a holiday to go to the Tour de France with 10 other people.
Yeah, but I mean, Grassroots Australia is actually it's a UK business which set up a subsidiary in Australia. This massive sort of events arm. Anyway, we won't go too much into that,
but that's what Cycling Australia should be
pursue
doing.
The grassroots.
That's right.
That's what my belief in is. And then, maybe the national championships and maybe the national road series, but everything else, I think it should be done by private.
But even things like that, I mean, I find it funny in some ways looking back. So I remember going to some of these events and you could see the amount of infrastructure they put down and there was no one there. So you've got these big Subaru banner, which, I mean, Subaru was obviously underwriting the series, and you've got these huge amounts of people following it. You've got this, you know, Lucy Hinchey and, you know, all the, like, you know, the media people, and yet, you know, Mark Van Aken, these sort of people who have sort of drifted out of the sort of whole administration. But, you know, they had a lot of hangers-on, and they were trying to create something which ultimately, I don't know, certainly for some of these smaller National Road Series events, the amount of money you're doing to underwrite them is never going to be sustainable. I mean, not certainly in the short run. Maybe in the long run, but that was not the impression I got. I thought it was like, you know, let's do everything now, and it wasn't quite caught up.
Is this? I wonder if it's interesting.
Well, it is interesting.
No, people care about cycling Australia.
I wonder if the listeners are sitting there thinking, oh, can we just move on to the racing? Okay. Or I wonder, because we could talk about this for a long time because there's so many. It's so problematic.
Well, because we're interested, but again, getting back to what you were saying about the mammals, is that it's perfectly easy for them to just go to a bike shop, buy a bike that's worth 10K, and go out and ride with their mates. They don't need Cycling Australia to do that.
Yeah.
That's the thing, you know. So and to be quite honest, I'm sure that CA is not even on their radar at any real time. I mean, they're going to watch Spring Classics, Tour de France, maybe the World Championships on TV, and
the rest of the time
they're just hanging out with the boys,
the bunchy,
just doing a bunch of rides Saturday, Sunday.
And a lot of the ground that in terms of membership, I won't say any more because I don't want to talk about this forever. But they've already ceded to organisations like, you know, Bicycle Network and, you know, Bicycle New South Wales, all these other organisations already have huge membership bases.
Like, yes.
Cycling Australia has, I think, 20,000 something members. I think Bicycle Network Victoria has something like 50 something thousand. That's just Victoria. I mean, it's like they've lost the battles that they should have won years ago, and that's half the problem.
Yeah. I think people do care about it because it's it's funded by the taxpayer, and then if you look at the debacle that Australian swimming went through with their lack of success at the last Olympic Games, people were asking questions about the organisation, the way it's run, the way it deals with athletes, its medal winning program. So I think people do care about it.
Yeah, I think. I mean, ultimately, it's government money, isn't it? A lot of it. So,
right.
We should be caring about it in some ways.
I want to know where my taxes are going.
Yeah, yeah.
Ditto here.
Yeah, they're going here to fund this podcast. all right, guys, let's move on to another government shambles in the team pursuit in France. All right, super quickly, for those that haven't seen the opening day of action from the Track World Championships in France, in brief, as Australia began its qualifying run barely out of the first corner, Luke Davison's left crank arm and chain ring broke clear of the bike, causing Alex Edmondson to puncture and Mitchell Mulhern to crash behind. While the team did restart, one has to wonder, how does this happen at an elite competition like a world championship? Rob,
I think it was the right crank arm, but
I think they both came off. But no. The left came off first because it was on the inside.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But either way, it was a spectacular mechanical failure.
Mm.
And I spoke to you about it when we were discussing this podcast possibility today, and I got quite passionate about it because I quite simply said, if I went to a bike shop and asked them to fix my bike and I rode away and the crank came off, I'd be pissed off. I'd just be back there just screaming at the mechanic saying, hang on a second, I paid you to do this properly.
Yep.
If I was at a world championship and I had someone looking after my bike and I thought when I got on it would be functioning and it didn't, I would be beside myself.
Mm.
I'd be throwing chairs and carrying on and really making a big tantrum. I think Luke Davison, I don't know his reaction, I don't know what happened, but it was probably much more passive than mine would have been.
That's
but
the like, YouTube video I wanted to see, the after, not the crank arm falling off.
Like, but
I
seriously,
wanted to see the dummy spit.
How can that happen? We're not talking about even like, okay, Colombia's got a good cycling heritage, but it's not a small federation. We've just gone on about how well-funded CA is. Whoever the mechanic is who did this ought to be hung up to dry and so said, you're not welcome anymore. This is a debacle.
What? they do get another shot at it.
And I think it's important. We sit here. I want to say this. I sit there and I support Australian cycling. I support cycling on every level. I say, do it, do it, do it. And I love it and I laud it when it's great. But when it's stupid, it should be pointed out.
Hung out to dry.
And this is just terrible.
Especially on a bike which is just so simple in its mechanics. Well, there's no derailleur or anything like that. I'm not saying a nincompoop could assemble a bike, but really there's so few elements to it and that the mechanics need to test and get right. So really that's why you see so few mechanical failures in tracks. Most of the time you see punctures.
Yeah.
And that's something people can live with.
And something as well that I think people can live with is something snapping, like breaking, the amount of power ripping through maybe a handlebar or
products
something.
Products are strong enough now to withstand coming out of a start game.
Yeah. Well,
they really are.
But a crank arm is not just breaking, but falling off. That implies that not assembled.
I don't know if it snapped. I've only got Instagram images to go on. But
I think we need to clarify exactly what happened first, and we don't really know that. So whether or not the crank bolt, it actually came out because it wasn't properly done up, or whether there was an actual, say, axle failure,
we don't
exactly know. So, But in the end, it shouldn't. It's not the kind of thing you expect to see happen.
Someone in track cycling who knows a little bit about it, who I'll say was a gold medalist in the Commonwealth Games at one point, hypothesised, well, is it a good thing to have happened? Because Australia's got a great reputation in the team pursuit, and they weren't going terribly well. And they qualified fifth, which means that not in the medal ride.
Yeah, but then again...
They qualified fifth, which means they've got to go through, blah, blah, blah.
That's right.
Yeah. And it's difficult. So was it just a strategy to make sure they didn't make the final?
No. All right. Well, I'm so confused with that hypothesis.
And after hearing that, I want to know who shot John F. Kennedy.
Yeah. And Mr. Burns.
It was a patsy.
Monty Burns. It was Maggie Simpson.
No, sorry. I just didn't mean to sort of try and create controversy where none was due, but I just think that a crank falling off in the world championship is crap.
Yeah.
Can we just... Are we going to talk a little bit about what happened at track today?
Yes, please.
Just very quickly.
World record.
Because there was a world record today. An important world record. So.
Yeah, go on.
First day of the Lunar New Year.
That's right.
And we get a Chinese world record.
World record. And in the women's team sprint. And Jin Jingong and Dan Shizhong,
yeah,
I think I got that right, did 32.034 over Russia.
That's fast.
In the final.
It's fast.
Which is quick for those people who know about this sort of thing. So, I think it's worth noting. And it's also worth noting that Germany and Australia were the two countries who contested the bronze medal. And it's also the first time in a very long time that Germany has not... Won a medal
in the team sprint.
That's right.
And we should also reference that New Zealanders everywhere would be devastated.
I don't actually want to talk about all the tracks because we've got plenty of time. But
but New Zealand did the fastest time in the team sprint and then they got disqualified, so they didn't win it.
And French won and it was awesome.
All right, Rob, you guys are both banned.
And Simon
Gerrans
got the silver medal in the road race in Ponferrada.
One final
in
thing.
In September.
A reminder, there's plenty more coverage of the Track World Championships on Cycling Central all this week. But we'll just quickly go to the comments of the week and then we'll wrap the whole thing up. Just comments of this week from Terry Bosworth on Facebook. He said, in relation to the Armstrong suit, where finally Mr. Armstrong is going to be paying up some dollars to those he's wronged. This was one of the many legitimate lawsuits Armstrong launched against innocent companies and individuals to cover up his doping and ongoing lie. The victim has merely asked the previous ruling be reviewed based on Armstrong's subsequent confession on Oprah. Hardly a witch hunt. If you lost $9 million... on the back of a lie and the perpetrator subsequently admitted lying, I'm sure you would ask for a review. And Callum Dwyer.
Absolutely.
Yep. Terry. Yep. Absolutely. I thought it was a good comment. Summed it up all very nicely. And Callum Dwyer said on Cycling Australia, said elite success doesn't bring members in through the door. Personally, I think the big challenge for CA is making competitive cycling accessible to the average Joe who hasn't got a pro VO2 max or has the time to ride at least 250 kilometres a week. And that's something we probably already
touched
on. We
pretty much suggested the same sentiment.
So Callum,
take cycling to the schools.
Don't worry about it, Callum.
Yeah,
it's already on top of it.
Totally.
Yeah. All right, guys, thanks for being around. And Rob, I don't want to hear anything more out of you except for Simon Guerin's analysis next
week. Wear your helmet.
Yeah.
And ride on the left of the white line in the bike lane.
Good to have you
and
as
look
always.
Look for mirrors.
And tanning.
And car doors.
Thank you, Al.
Yeah.
Oh, that's all I'll say because these guys have said too much.
Yeah. Rob said too much.
We should have just had Michael O'Reilly in here.
That was a good note to end. All right. Thanks for joining us. Don't forget, for all your news, blogs, videos, pics and more, we're always online, creating content at sbs.com.au/cyclingcentral. And once more, to our Australian listeners, don't forget to tune in to the Track World Championships, live and exclusive to SBS. Bye now.